You're listening to The Purple Mystic, a podcast for the modern witch, with your host, Natalie Sedgwick. Welcome back to The Purple Mystic Podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Sky Alexander, who is the author of more than 30 fiction and nonfiction books, and is the author of The Modern Guide to Witchcraft, which I happen to have in my hand. Welcome, Ms. Alexander. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to talk with you.
Yes, I'm super pleased to get you on because I don't think I've seen you on too many other podcasts. I was like, yes. Let's get her on and let's see where we can go with this. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background? How did you come to the path? Because I know you've written some books on tarot and you also have done some books on feng shui, which I should probably learn more about. I'm sure my house is an aberration. But I'm more familiar with your Modern Guide to Witchcraft and that series of books. So how did you come to the path of
Well, I guess I would say that I was born a witch. I just didn't know it at the time because where I grew up and in the times I grew up, you didn't talk about stuff like that. But I was always interested in metaphysical things. And when I was 11, my mother and I participated in an ESP study that Duke University was doing. And I think that really was sort of a trigger for me. And I read my first astrology book when I was 11. And this path just seemed to make more sense to me than a lot of the other things that had been presented as ways that I should travel through life. This just felt more real. It felt more comfortable. And I guess the sacredness of it spoke to me in a way that conventional religion didn't.
That's very interesting because I found that a lot of us kind of come out, I guess, of the broom closet, so to speak, or find ourselves somewhat on this path at such a young age. Usually it's around 10 or 11. That's kind of where I first started going this way. Now, of course, as minors, you know, we don't have a lot of authority. It sounds like your family, though, your mother was very supportive in you finding your own way. Is that true?
My mother was always interested in metaphysical stuff. She didn't do any of it in a professional way or even in a very serious way, but she always was intrigued and read a lot and encouraged me in that area, yes. And by the way, I wanted to say something about your comment that you were 11 and you know other people who at about that age started opening up to new ideas maybe, or new ways of doing things, or new interests came into their lives. And there's a reason for that astrologically. When you're 11, the planet Jupiter, which is connected with personal expansion, spirituality, higher knowledge, makes a complete circuit through your birth chart, and it returns to the same spot it was in at the time that you were born. And so a lot of people at that time in their lives start opening up and exploring areas, whether they are physical, like through travel, or whether they are through education or something else, that will lead them into a more open and more exciting path in life.
That's very interesting. Well, you know, and it's weird because, well, I say weird, but isn't everything about us weird? You want to be that way about it. For me, it was kind of a almost a coincidental type thing. I was raised Church of Christ. I know you split your time between, I want to say Michigan and Texas.
Well, I used to between Massachusetts and here, but I didn't go this past 2 years.
Oh, okay. Okay. But you are in Texas then?
I'm in Texas, right?
Me too.
Where are you?
I'm actually in north of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex in a little place called Aubrey, if you're familiar with North Texas.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, we're right on Highway 380, most dangerous highway in the nation. I might just put that out there. I had a state trooper tell me that, but we're halfway between Denton and McKinney.
Okay. Well, good.
How about yourself? Where are you?
I am in the Hill Country.
Oh, I love the Hill Country. I grew up in San Antonio. So.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, I'm in Bernie, and I used to spend a lot of time out at Pedernales Falls and Enchanted Rock.
Yeah, well, I'm in Kerrville, so you've probably driven through here at some point.
Oh, yeah. Kerrville, did you say?
Yes.
James Avery.
Yes.
If you're a Texas witch, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, charm bracelets and charm rings. James Avery, he's the man, which is funny because he does a lot of Christian jewelry.
Well, he did. I have a lot of his jewelry.
We do, don't we? It's like a Texas thing. It's like, I didn't know that mums were a Texas thing either until somebody, I was trying to make some for my daughter, and the person at the store that was checking me out was new to Texas and was like, can I ask you, what is a mum? And I mean, my face, I must have looked like somebody that was in complete utter shock. You know, my hand went up to my chest and I went, oh, you know, and I made that face. I was like, you don't know what a mum is? Oh my, you know. So for anybody that's out there that's listening from somewhere other than Texas and has no idea what I'm talking about, look them up. And honey, the bigger, the better is all I have to say. You'd be surprised. But yeah.
Well, you might be surprised if you came here recently to see that there is a growing witchy community here. We have a witch shop right in downtown. We have another shop that's kind of metaphysical, has other things too, but they do tarot readings, astrology readings, tea leaf readings in the store. And then another shop that is also oriented toward a lot of metaphysical stuff, as well as holistic healing, all within a block of each other in downtown. So
that's incredible. I was in Kerrville a couple of years ago, but it was, we didn't drive around it. We just happened to stop in because we were staying in a little Airbnb that's in an old Hacienda ranch out there in, I want to say Bernie, but I don't think it's Bernie, Bandera.
Oh, yeah.
In Bandera. But I do love the Hill Country. I think that there is something very sacred about the Hill Country of Texas. And if anybody's never been out here, I know Texas gets kind of a rough rap in a lot of ways, but really everyone has been very welcoming here. I mean, I live in North Texas, which is smack dab middle of the Bible Belt, but I have not been met with a lot of negative responses. People more want to know, curious, you know, but I also have learned how to kind of phrase it where people don't go, oh, right off the bat, because I'm actually a member of the OBOD. So I come at it from I'm an ovate. And so then they ask, well, what's an ovate? Well, let me tell you, and so then you kind of launch into a discussion about, you know, where, how Druidry and Wicca have similar roots,
right?
Where it comes from, how it's an earth-based religion. And they tend to kind of take that a little better around here. But I do know there's a wonderful metaphysical shop there in San Antonio called Unlimited Thought. It's not too terribly far from you. That's absolutely fantastic. I know they moved from their original location, but I don't know where they moved to.
Yeah, well, I think that there is such a growing interest now that even in places like this, people are starting to be more curious. They're more open than they were when I first moved here. And every once in a while, I get somebody, one of my neighbors who looked me up online and called and said, how can you be a witch? You're so nice. Whoever told witches can't be nice.
I love those teachable moments. You know, that speaks right to the stereotype of what people think of. And I tell them, I said, look, you know, you're thinking Hollywood witches. Mm-hmm. You're thinking Salem, you know, history. You're not thinking about, you're not looking at who we are as a people. Yeah. And what we practice. Allow me to educate you on what we really do believe. And I only eat children on Wednesdays. So you're safe, probably. But I find that tends to be a lot more of an open door than people want to realize around here. But let's talk a little bit about then how you, are you formally a member of a coven in that area or?
Not at this point. When I lived in Massachusetts, I used to work with a group, but I am not part of an actual formal group now.
Okay, so you're practicing more solitary at this point in time.
Yeah, pretty much at this time. And I have at other times worked with a specific partner. There are a lot of people here that are interested in similar things, and it may very well be that I will eventually move into being with another group and working with them.
But yeah, it's a touchy subject, I think, because there's a lot of the term gatekeeping gets thrown around a lot where, if you're not initiated in a group, then you're not really a witch because you can't really. But then I think about it and I'm like, how many of us, how frequently do you really get together with your group to practice? And most of us are doing things on a daily basis that are solitary anyway. So I always find that a sensitive subject. I understand what they're saying, and there's something to be said for tradition and having a formal mentorship type of teaching in a group setting. I think that group work is different than individual work in, mm-hmm. in some ways. It may be better depending on what you're trying to do. But I don't think that solitary practice is any less effective.
No, I agree with you. And I think both have their advantages and disadvantages and suit us in different ways at different times in our lives.
Absolutely. So when you set out, did you want to write always, or was it something that just came up where you finally wanted to share your knowledge to a bigger forum, and so you wrote your first book? And what was your first book?
Actually, I knew I wanted to be a writer before I could actually write. I used to tell stories before I started school. So I was about four, I guess. And I always knew that I wanted to write. I started writing for my local newspaper when I was 15, and started writing for radio when I was 18, and for TV when I was 25. So I always knew what I wanted to do. My first published book was in, 1988, although I wrote for a lot of magazines and newspapers and other types of publications before that. But my first published book was in 88, and it's still in print. It's called Planets and Signs. It's about, it's an astrology book. And I've been doing it ever since. I actually have almost 50 now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So quite a few. I know there's a lot to the modern series. And so, and that was where I got introduced to you. A friend of mine gave me the Modern Guide to Witchcraft for my birthday. And it's a lovely book. I have to say I'm a bibliophile. Mm-hmm. So I'm the kind of person that like opens a book and sticks their nose into it and sniffs it. That's just me.
I do too.
And I really like the pages. I liked the layout of the book in terms mm-hmm. of, for someone who is just stepping out on their own in the craft, I will say. I found it to be very comprehensive, although it's not horribly thick. It was an easy read. Obvious that you've got a lot of very, very varied background, like your section on the elementals was very good, I thought, and a lot better than a lot of them. Because when you Google witchcraft books now, there's like zillions. You Google moon magic, there's bazillions of books out there. So it takes a lot for something to stand out. But I found that this was a good one to have in the library. And I loved your bitchy coworker spell, by the way. Could be useful, not just for a coworker, but for, somebody that's in your space. But what led you to writing those books?
Well, actually, I would have to say that they were proposed to me by my publisher, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. And they wanted to, I had written a lot of other books before this series came out, and a lot of things in various metaphysical areas, as well as, like you mentioned, feng shui, which I've done for a long time. And I've been doing astrology for more than 45 years and tarot for probably 25. So when they decided they wanted to do a witchcraft series, I already had a background and a lot of, credibility, I guess. And so I was able to bring various things to that series, including, as you, I think you mentioned, there's a tarot book in the series that's done very well also, and one that just came out on witchcraft and fairies, and there's a lot of history and connection between that. And I'd written books about goddess mythology. So they came to, and in fact, most of the time, publishers will come to me and ask me if I want to write a book for them. I don't often pitch books to anybody else anymore, except in the fiction area.
Now let's talk a little bit about your fiction. Is your fiction a specific genre, or is it just you have lots of stories in your mind and you kind of start putting them on paper and then out comes a book?
Both. I do have one that just came out a few months ago that's the first in a mystery series. I like writing mysteries because they're puzzles to figure out. And they're also modern day morality tales where the bad guy gets the comeuppance at the end and everything works out, which doesn't happen in life as we know. But there's also the hero's tale or the heroine's tale, the journey that into self-discovery through which you have to put yourself through trials and challenges and not necessarily know what's going on or how it's going to turn out in order to find yourself and to see what you're really capable of. And so to me, they're more than just entertainment.
They are, definitely. I have written my whole life. I've always been a writer, short stories. I always have little stories in my head and I carry notebooks with me all the time. And This is something I've talked about with Timothy Roderick, is it's almost a compunction. You have to write. You must get it out. There's a thought. I have to write it down and I have to, but writing mysteries is a special talent because suspense novels and mysteries take a certain amount of forethought. And you have to be able to weave it in a way that keeps your reader interested, which is very different than like some of the other books, like almost like how-to type books, which is what I see. The modern guide to witchcraft is kind of almost a how-to.
It is,
yes. Step into it. So, it's a totally different type of writing. And I just want the, listeners to understand that that takes an incredible amount of skill to be able to go from one type of writing to another. And especially in the areas of mystery and suspense. So that's very admirable.
It's fun for me. It's an escape from reality.
Absolutely. Lord, don't we all need that right now?
Yes. And I write historic mysteries. Mine take place in the mid-1920s. So, I don't have to deal with anything that's going on in the world right now. It's a total escape for me. And I learn a lot about history in the process because I have to do a tremendous amount of research. And history was never my favorite subject in school, but I have to say that through doing all this research and going to the places that I write about, I've learned a lot and it's been very, very exciting.
That's pretty good. Well, do you ever do things like book signings or book tours? Oh, I know sure. A lot of people have kind of set that aside due to COVID, but is that something that you have done in the past for either your witchcraft or your fiction books?
Yes, both. And I'm actually doing one on January 8th that our library. And I don't do as much as I did years ago because, the lockdowns and all the people being afraid to come out. So for the past 2 years, my speaking engagements have mostly been on Zoom or in other very small venues, not big conferences. But I still do them and hope to be able to do more.
Yeah, I'm hoping that things are now opening out and that people will start to come out and do things like that. Well, have you ever, how, you mentioned that you lived in Massachusetts, you said?
Yes, yeah, for 31 years.
Oh, wow. Okay, is that, did you grow up in Texas or did you grow up somewhere else? Or
I grew up in a lot of different places. My father's company transferred him every year or two, so I traveled a lot when I was a kid, but I moved to Massachusetts when I was 24 and lived there for 31 years, and I loved it. I still love it. Not this time of year so much. I like being in Texas a lot better now because it's warm, but
it's 80 degrees today, folks, for those of you listening.
Yeah, I think it's about 70 here.
Yeah, December 26th, and my car thermostat said 82. Yeah. So, yeah.
I rub it in. I do.
I'm not a big fan of the heat. So for me, I'm like, this is not winter weather. It needs to be at least 50 or lower. But yeah, I know a lot of people that just relish this kind of weather. My husband loves it. And I'm like, nope, this is not winter. This is fake winter.
That's okay with me. I had enough snow in my life.
I was going to say after that February snowstorm, however, I'm sure a lot of people are like, no, we're good with snow.
Well, I never had any of those problems when I lived in Massachusetts, I have to say, because there everybody knows how to deal with cold weather and we're prepared for it. So you don't lose your water for 16 days like I did.
Exactly. Well, you know, the bad part for us was, you know, I was like, okay, well, we can just switch to teletherapy. I don't have to drive anywhere. I can do teletherapy with my clients, but there were the rolling blackouts. So when I was fortunate that I did not lose power or water in my home because we have a fire station just up the street. And so, you know, they maintained. So we were very fortunate, but everybody else in my neighborhood was just dying. I was giving out our firewood to people and, blankets and stuff because they had no heat, no firewood or anything to warm themselves. And I couldn't do the teletherapy with a lot of my clients because they were under the blackout.
Yeah.
It was no bueno. It was a bad time. It was a hard winter, the whole 1 week of it that we had.
It was. It was.
So, of all the places in Texas to go, what brought you to the Hill Country?
Well, my parents lived in Brownsville for a while when I was young. I did not live there, down in the valley. And then my mother and my sister and my brother all lived in Dallas area and Fort Worth for quite a while. And I knew I didn't want to live either of those places, but when my partner retired, we wanted to go someplace warm. And so we just got in the car and drove from Massachusetts until, what we said was we tied a snow shovel to the back of the car. And when people started asking us what it was, we knew we could stop. We just really liked the Hill Country, and it seemed like one of the prettier parts of Texas. I've been through most of it except the Panhandle. And this, I think, is kind of it's not as hot as West Texas. It's not humid like East Texas or the Valley. And it's kind of rural, but it's still a town. So there's stuff. It's not like being, you know, way out in West Texas and there's nothing else around you.
Exactly. Yeah. So, oh, there's El Paso. Yay. After hours of nothing. Yeah. No, I definitely understand. And I do think that, you know, you're close to San Antonio. You're not too far from Austin. So you've not got some good cities close to you, but far enough away that you have to actually drive to get there. So that's always nice. I personally absolutely love the Hill Country. To me, it is totally sacred ground. I was absolutely shocked when we were down in that area the last time. And it's been a couple of years now because obviously it was before COVID. But I wanted so badly to go back to Pedernales Falls and Enchanted Rock, which was always my go-to sanctuary place to meditate. I didn't understand that's what I was doing at the time. But when I was younger and I had a car, that was my getaway place. Mm-hmm. And when we got out there this last time, there were people everywhere. They were all over the rock, kids screaming, picking up things, you know. It was a place where I always felt like I should not take things from, that I should leave it.
I agree.
And you know, I mean, there are times when I see, you know, a feather or a rock or, it's that druid in me that goes, oh, you know, that's a nice little, you know, it speaks to me, but there I never would. And to see people just, you know, climbing all over it and all the noise and, I was just like, keep driving, keep driving. My husband's like, are you sure? And I'm like, keep driving, just go, you know, don't stop. I was disappointed.
I agree with you. That was always a place that I felt had some magical energy about it. And it is discovered now by too many people, in my opinion.
Sadly, yes. And you know, that's the funny thing. There are only two places in the state that I really felt strongly that kind of magical energy that you're mentioning. That was one. And the other one was Cato Lake out in East Texas, which is the only natural lake in Texas. And the cypress trees, the weird thing is, if you go on the Louisiana side of the lake, it just looks like a lake, like any other lake you'd see here. But on the Texas side, with all of the cypress trees, it's very swampy and very, it's very mystical, very magical there too. And so if I had to be in one of two places to retire, it would be either the Hill Country or in Cato Lake.
Well, if you find your way down here sometime, give me a call and we'll get together.
It'd be nice to have to do that, because my husband actually owns property in Llano County. And we've always had a plan to put a little house on that property and have like a weekend getaway kind of place to go. And it would be wonderful to have some fellowship. I think that's one thing that I have missed a lot, is that sense of community that you were talking about earlier. Because that's one bad part to being solitary, is that you don't get that kind of community. And as a member of the OBOD, there are seed groups around here, and there are groves that exist in the area. But because of COVID, we haven't really been able to get together. And, you know, I haven't had an opportunity to really sit down with a lot of people and just talk. You know, this podcast came out of that, my need to talk about witchy things with like-minded people. So let's talk a little bit about spellcraft, because you do have a grimoire in this book. And I'm sure you probably have similar chapters in many of your other books.
Yes.
But when you sit down, okay, this is hard for me to talk about, because for me, it's so ingrained in who I am. I do it 90% of the time without even a lot of conscious thought, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Like, to me, it's just what I do and who I am. So to talk about it requires me to sit down and think about my process. And sometimes it's sloppy, what I call sloppy spell casting. And sometimes it's very formal, you know, with all of the grand ritual, as I call it, where I'll pull out my altar, you know, portable altar table, and I'll put it up and I'll put out all the accoutrements, and I'm like in my zone and I'm, you know, putting it out there. But for me, I do simple things. Like, I have two dragons that are my servitors and I feed them daily. To me, that's magic. That's working my spellcraft, because that's keeping those servitors working and alive. So I feed my dragons and I talk to them every day. And, you know, it's simple things like that. It's murmuring some words over food that I'm preparing, you know, be it for health and wealth or, you know, what have you. So when you do spell work, do you find it's kind of the same way for you, or is your spellcraft always very conscious and formal and I know these ingredients?
Not at all. It's probably very similar to what you do. I think what happens is, or at least this is what I see happening with the witches that I know, is that it's part of our lives. It's part of everything that we do. And it's not something that I necessarily set up with a conscious intention and get all my tools together, like you were saying, and lay them all out on the altar and write everything down. And I live it all the time. So my spell work is ongoing. Now, when I write these books, such as the Modern Guide to Witchcraft and the Grimoire and Spellbook, I'm talking mostly to people who are relatively new to this path. And so I see my job as bringing this esoteric knowledge down to earth so that people who are just starting won't feel intimidated by it. They can get involved right away and they can start seeing results in their lives. And for many people, having the candles and the wand and the, you know, your all your other accoutrements is a way of focusing your mind. You don't need any of that stuff. It just helps you with the ambiance. And
that's what I tell a lot of people. A witch's most powerful tool is their mind. It's
the only one you
what's
need.
In your mind and in your heart. The tools that we use are helpful to focus the energy, especially if you're trying to cast a spell and you're emotionally otherwise occupied. It does help to have those tools to focus it, and they do add power to your spell. I mean, for sure. Yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't use them at all. But yeah, you don't have to have them. And I think that's what a lot of people get caught up in that are new in the craft, is they think they have to go out and buy all these fabulous tools, you know, like the largest cauldron they can find and the biggest, you know, crystal ball they can get their hands on, which I'm not going to lie, my Lucille, she's a beaut, she's a big one. But I happen to get a really good deal on her. Otherwise, I never would have bought it. Ended up being a birthday present. But, you know, for me, that was important. I felt I needed a large area for myself. But it wasn't, you know, that somebody told me, oh, if it's not this big, it's never going to work.
Yeah, and I love all my beautiful tools, and I do enjoy using them. But I don't need to do that. The things that I find to be most complementary, if you will, to my own energy would be working with crystals and gemstones and working with plants, because these are living entities, these are living beings that their energy and mine combine for a particular purpose.
Right, exactly. It's almost like having your own personal coven in non-human form. But that's absolutely true. And I find that that's a lot of what I do. I do a lot of candle magic. Because I like the element of fire. But my crystals are very important to me, and my herbs for sure, living and dried. You know, and to me, it still carries the essence of that plant, and that to me, and that speaks to the Obod side of things too. It's very much I can go out in nature and find what I need.
Right.
I don't necessarily have to have it. And that's something that I kind of wanted to hit on and talk with you, that I like to bring up with a lot of my other witches, because I like to get other people's perspectives on it. But for me, the first step in practicing the craft is finding where you are and connecting with where you are. Especially if you've moved to a new place. I think before you can do any major spell work, you need to connect with that land, whether that be by getting out and taking a walk and learning the native plants that are in the area. If it's learning about the indigenous populations that lived in that land before you did, and making some sort of connection and offering with them to bring them in as allies, you know, and ancestors to a degree. And I think that that's really, really important. And I think it's something that gets glossed over a lot.
I agree with you. And I have to say, I don't feel as connected to the land here in Texas as I did when I lived in Massachusetts. I lived on an island. And for me, the water energy was really powerful there, and something that I felt a very strong connection to. And I built a, you know what a labyrinth is, right?
Yes.
Okay. I built a labyrinth in the woods behind my house and used that for a lot of my ritual. And that was a very grounding and also energizing place for me to work. I'm still trying to do it here. And the thing that I connect with most here are the beautiful old live oak trees. I have all these wonderful live oaks.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I make a lot of connection with them, but I do miss the water element that I used to be able to work with.
Well, watch the mesquite trees because they have nasty little thorns. I'll just say that because there's a lot of mesquite around there too, but it's a beautiful tree.
Oh, yeah.
The live oaks. I grew up in Live Oak, Texas, which is just outside of San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And the live oaks in that area are just phenomenal. And again, you know, the Obod side of me goes, oak trees, yay! you know, but in Texas, we honestly have, I think it's like 16 different species of oak. Live oak, red oak, white oak. There's a lot of oak here.
Chin oak.
Yeah, exists. Yeah. My husband bought me a little book called Trees of Texas, and it's a little handbook. And I was actually using that because part of my ovate training was connecting with the Ojum. And, you know, a lot of those trees that are in the Ojum that the Ojum is based on are not here. You know, we don't have rowan trees here. Right. So I was looking for a Texas equivalent. I'm actually working on a book. Which is a Texas Ojum. And it's connecting with the different types of trees and finding things that carry the same energies or are from the same families as the trees in Europe that they use that we don't have here. Because I think in order to connect fully with that, especially as a divinatory system, you need to be connected and you need to be able to have your own trees to connect with in that same way. And so, oak is a big one.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's interesting that you have sort of translated the Druids and the Irish, their trees into what we would use here as our divination and language system, as the Ojum was.
Yes. It's slowly coming together. I'm still working on it, but it is a work that's very important to me because I really felt like I needed to be able to connect. But if I can't get, you know, I do have a nice Ojum set from England. That's each few is made from the tree. So I have that bit of that tree here, but
I have those too.
I may not always have that with me. And if I wanted to connect with a specific energy, I would need, you know, to know what is the equivalent here. And to me, that's just part of being a witch in Texas because Ovates are witches. So, and it's funny because, you know, my husband is an odd duck. I'll just put that out there. He's 1 minute very supportive, the next minute railing against all things witchcraft and it's BS and he, you know, doesn't believe any of it. It's all bunk. And then I'll get a really nice set of ceremonial robes for Yule or for Christmas. So I'm like, but like I said, you know, he was the one that gave me that book and that's what gave me the inspiration to really learn the trees and to get to know that. And I think that's a really important part of my craft and my spellcraft. Personally, because I will utilize items from the trees around here and a lot of my spells. So I do think
that's interesting.
Yeah, I do think that's very, very important. Since you don't feel as connected to the land here, do you think that impacts your practice at all? Or do you think that it's so internalized at this point, it really doesn't matter?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about that. It probably impacts it somewhat because as we've been talking, you know, about how important place is and being part of the place, connected to the place where you are, how important that is. It probably does, but I also, I find that I work with different kinds of energies here. The energy here is, well, as you know, it's more fiery. And so I'm working more with fire energy and air than I did when I lived on the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So
just shifting my focus, I guess, to a different part of the elements. I mean, different elements themselves.
And two elements that seem almost polar in you know, their their nature, you know, water puts out fire, you know, so it's, yeah, I can see where that would be a big shift, a big shift. So how long have you lived in the area you're in now, if you don't mind my asking?
16 years.
Okay. So you've been there for a while. You've had a chance to adjust. I'm sure at first it was a little bit of a shocker.
Initially, yes, but I like it. I wouldn't move back to Massachusetts permanently. I do hope to go back again in the summers, you know, when all this COVID stuff goes away. But I really do like a lot of it. This has a lot of deep power in different ways for me.
And I think it carries a lot of animal energy with it, because we have a lot of little critters out there. Foxes, armadillos, which are kind of their own unique.
I have all those guys in my yard.
Yeah, we have an armadillo that keeps digging in my garden right by my window, and I'll hear him kicking the dirt up and hitting the window.
They're pretty destructive, but I think they're cool.
Yeah, they're really cool. They're so ugly, they're darn cute. And this little fella, she's fat thing. And you know, they're blind as a bat. I mean, I actually walked up on one and flat out picked it up one day because, you know,
they're deaf too.
Yes. And but you do have to be careful because they do carry leprosy.
I've heard that. I don't touch them. I just watch them.
I had gloves on, but I did pick this little sucker up and, you know, carted it a ways before I took it back. But that was a stupid kid. I just thought he was really cool and I was afraid he was gonna get hurt. So but they're, you know, they're really neat little guys. And I, you know, I like to kind of utilize their energy for protection spells because they have that armor that they can roll themselves up in. And so, you know, snagging a little bit of dirt from their, you know, burrow or, you know, just connecting with the essence of them through an image is
really good. To work with animal magic a lot, and I'm hoping in the coming year to be able to do another book in the Modern Witchcraft series that deals with spirit animals and also working with familiars. Do you have a familiar?
I do not have a familiar, actually. You know, it's kind of funny because my cousin who lives there in Canyon Lake, her dog is her familiar. Uh-huh. And I have friends that have cats that are their familiars, and I have one friend that has a rabbit that is her, but I do not. I have never, but as much as I love my animals, my pets are not my familiars. You know,
they aren't. I mean, not every cat or every dog or every rabbit or horse is a familiar.
Right. The closest I have come is that there are, I work with the Morrigan, and I had some crows that took up a roost behind my house, and our house backs up to a greenway. We lived here for years upon years, probably about 10 years, and never had a single crow in the area. And then when I started working with the Morrigan, we got two, a mated pair. Now there's like eight. You know, it went from an attempted murder to a full-out murder. And my husband's totally convinced they're here because of me. But I do feed them, you know, and I go out and talk to them, and they come very close. But that's but I wouldn't consider, I consider them more chums than I would familiars. I do watch them, and I do think they give me signs. I know when something's going on with the weather. But I think it's just, I'm in tune with their behavior.
I really like crows. I wish I had some. I don't see them here very often.
I love them. I have always liked them. We get a lot of grackles too, which are from the same family, but they're a lot smaller and not nearly as aggressive, I don't think, as crows. But we get crows, ravens, and blue martins, purple martins, or grackles, as they're known around here. Quite a bit. And you do get a lot of grackles down in your area, but more like in the San Antonio area. We always had a lot of purple martins out there. But I'm sure you'll be seeing some. I'm sure they're about that area. But I love working with the animal essences that are in this area. And I think the Hill Country is just alive and thriving with animal energy.
I have quite a few animals. I mean, I live in the country, so I have deer and antelope and all kinds of foxes and jackrabbits and, you know, exactly. Lots of good stuff too.
Snakes, lots of snakes.
Well, you know, I haven't seen very many snakes. I don't know why. It might be because I've got a couple feral cats that maybe keep them down, but I have yet to see a rattlesnake in all the time I've lived here.
Really? You know, I'll be honest with you though, even in all the time that I would go out there to go hiking just to get away from home growing up, I never saw a rattlesnake, at least not a living one, on any of the foot trails that I was on. But when we were in Arizona, we were going through one of the indigenous Anasazi, where the Anasazi lived in the caves.
Okay.
And as we were coming back up from there, we hear this. And I guess my two other daughters who were walking ahead of us must have woken it up. And it was telling us as we were standing next to it that it was not pleased we were there. And I was like, oh, cool. And I got like the best picture of it. Sitting up, my husband's like yanking me back. His hair is turning gray as we're standing there. He's like, those things can reach like twice their body length. And I was like, he wasn't going to hurt me. You know, so when we got to the end of that, we were the last people in. And as we were leaving, I showed the park ranger my picture. And he's like, that's a great picture. But I wouldn't have wanted to be that close. I was like, oh, he wasn't going to hurt me. You know, my husband's like, you don't know that. It was very funny. But yeah, I've only seen a rattlesnake out here even once in the middle of the road. Somebody ran it over and I felt very bad for it.
Hmm.
But we get a lot of rat snakes, king snakes.
Yeah, I've seen those.
And garter snakes. Yeah. Right. Moccasins. Those are the ones to watch out for.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those, but not any place where I was swimming. So it wasn't.
Yeah, they'll get up in your pool though. If you got a pool, they'll find it.
Yeah, I don't have one, so I guess I'm safe on that one.
Yeah, you're safe. But you know, I do love to go out and collect snake shed. I work a lot with snake shed. So that brings me back to my first point. What I was going to ask you, about when you said, preparing a spell. I think we got talking about how it becomes so ingrained that you don't really formally sit down, but if you're creating a spell, do you keep a grimoire at this point?
Well, most of them I've put into my books. You know, I know some people say you shouldn't share your spells with other people outside your coven or outside of your, you know, community, but I always do. And I figure, well, it's just guidance for people. They can adapt it the way they want to, but because I'm writing for a relatively newbie audience, you know, I'm not writing for experienced witches really. I want to give them at least some grounding in how you put a spell together, perhaps,
right. So
what things you might want to use that are going to, is that you're tapping the energies of particular stones or particular plants, but you're also coordinating that with your own energy. So I write most of my spells that I use and share them in my books with other people. But the only thing that I will do now probably is if I do a spell and I want to keep track of what the outcome was, mm-hmm. and how it mm-hmm. developed, I'll write that down in a journal.
That's kind of me. I have my grimoire. I actually don't keep it in my house. I keep it at my office. I have a personal office that's just mine. And that's where I do all of my, my spiritual work. And it's where I do my, you know, I offer my Reiki sessions there and my tarot readings there. But I do find that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of information in my grimoire because for me, it was, you know, where I kept my recipes. But I find that a lot of what I put in my grimoire is very basic. And when I do a spell, you know, I might do the same spell, but it's going to be a little bit different each time I do it because I tailor it to the specific situation. situation that I'm looking for, sure, using the materials I have on hand. So even if it's a money working spell, you know, to bring money into the house, the way I do it is going to be different every single time. So if I sat there and wrote down every single thing I did every single time, you know, I would have, you know, 4,000 money spells in my grimoire, and what would, yeah, be the purpose of that? So what I do is I will just write down the shell, right? The basic recipe that I want to pass on to my children or grandchildren or, you know, whoever may follow that gets my grimoire at some point in time. I hope someone receives it and utilizes it. But it's not something where, yeah, here's the thing, when I'm working a spell specifically, I don't share it with other people. Like, I've seen people that have posted pictures of their altars and they're, you know, oh, I'm working this spell, and, you know, they'll put pictures of their candles and all of that. And that's okay. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I personally don't do it just because you don't know what energy is going to be directed your way because of that. And, you know, we know that energy affects our spellcraft. So why put it out there and let someone else affect it?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Actively working a spell, right? But to put out your recipe is it's like sharing grandma's recipe for her special, you know, sugar, exactly, cookies, you know, for me, at least in my opinion, you know, except it's more, a little more sacred.
Yeah,
well, I don't know. Grandma's sugar cookies are pretty sacred. but you know what I'm saying? I mean, everybody's going to twist it to their own purposes anyway. And nobody should take somebody's spell and do it exactly the way it says on the paper. You've got to flavor it in your own way. Make it your own anyhow.
I think it has more power that way.
Absolutely, it does. You know, when you make it your own, you know. Now, I say that, but I'm also the person that follows grandma's cookie recipe to the letter because I want my cookies to taste just like hers. But spellcraft is different because it's individual. You know, I know that they say we should be secret, you know, and there are some things, like there are certain things within the Obad that are only for members of the Obad, and I don't share those things. But the general teachings are well known and books have been written about them, and everybody kind of knows our general philosophy. So, you know, talking about things in terms of generalities, I don't think is a bad thing. You know, and times are different now. Silence, exactly, was meant to be protective, right? You, yeah, had to keep secret. You had to keep silent. And, you know, I'm of the belief that the burning times are never super far away, because you've always got people that aren't going to like what you're doing.
Right.
But at the same time, if people are wanting genuinely to understand, then I think we have a duty to teach.
I feel the same way. And that's kind of what I see myself as doing with my writing, is hopefully teaching and inspiring people and encouraging them. And I love when I meet young women, I mean, teenagers or even younger sometimes, who are starting to get into this and they're really excited about it. And I want to nurture their enthusiasm, mm-hmm, and urge them to go forward with it. But absolutely, like you were saying with the, in the past, you did risk being burned at the stake if your grimoire was found, which was why so many magical workers of all stripes wrote in code.
Because, right,
you didn't want that information to fall into the wrong hands, and you didn't want anybody to know who had written it down in the first place.
Exactly. Your eye of newt wasn't exactly the eye of a newt. definitely, for sure. And you know, it's funny you bring that up, because there's a book, and I'm trying to remember the name of the book, but it's a big archaeological puzzle. I mean, they're just floored over. Nobody can figure out what this book is. It was written in a strange language. They haven't been able to decode part of it. Part of it talks about stars, you know, and has pictures of the heavens. And part of it's talking about plants. And, you know, they show the pictures that the person put. And I'm like, that's a grimoire.
Mm-hmm.
That's a grimoire. It was very obvious to me. They did a whole show on, they can't figure this book out and what it means. And I'm like, I'm screaming at the TV going, it's a grimoire. And my husband's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, that is somebody's flipping book of shadows.
Right.
Like, it's got an herbalism section. Got an anatomy section. for your herbalism, so you know what herbs are affecting what system. There's your astrology, and here's your tarot. I mean, to me, it was very clear. So I'm like writing a mad email to the you know, researcher that has the manuscript going, you have a grimoire in your possession.
Yeah, and they just didn't do that. They didn't do their research.
Exactly. I'm like, it's a grimoire. But I wish I could think of the name of this book now. It's going to drive me crazy. I'll be Facebooking you later going, it's called the this and that. But it's funny because, they can't figure it out. It was written in some sort of weird little language, but it's very precise, beautifully done. And that's funny. But you know, it's interesting you say young women, because it's not just young women anymore either. I'll tell you, there's another author, his name is Matt Aron, and he had a little guy, a young guy, who wrote him that was like, I loved your book. And, I'm trying to learn. He wrote like a cute little fan letter. I mean, this kid's like 8, and his mom was very encouraging, which I thought was a good sign. Mm-hmm. And so, at some point Matt posted a picture of the little guy, cause he sent him some things, and just made that kid's day. But it was so refreshing to me to see a parent who may or may not share that bent, allowing their child the freedom to learn how to develop their own gifts.
Right.
And that was very encouraging to me. Because, out here, I don't know. Well, you obviously, your mom was a little more encouraging. But, my mom went through cycles, because I know she had a very metaphysical interest. But I think her mother is the reason she didn't pursue it. Because I remember very clearly, my mother had a necklace. It was a gold pyramid. And you would open the bottom of the pyramid and you would put what you wanted to manifest on a paper, and you would put it inside that pyramid and wear it. Now tell me that's not spell casting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
that's not metaphysical manifestation right there. And my sister and I would fight over this necklace. We were like, we want the necklace. And I honestly don't even know where my mother got it from or if she still has it. But I remember her actually writing things down and putting it in there. But then she would do a complete, 180 turn. And it's, we can't celebrate Christmas because it's a pagan holiday, And I think that was her mother's influence.
Could
for
be.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
And so I had to be kind of secretive about my interests growing up. I couldn't be very open. And then, of course, at one point I myself went into the whole, Jesus freak. Because, it's a religion that rules by fear, which is what I like about the craft is for me, it is a religion. I work with a goddess. I work with a god. For me, it fits my personal definition of a religion, which is the set of principles that guides your day-to-day decisions. Your political view. That could be your personal spiritual path. But either way, that becomes your religion, because it is what you use to guide the moral decisions of your life.
Yeah, well, Wicca is a recognized religion. You can even have it on your dog tags if you're in the military.
Yes.
But not everybody who's a witch is Wiccan, and that's something
exactly.
I like to point out to people.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I brought up with Dave the Bard when I had him on the show. I asked him, explain the difference between like Wicca and Obod. And he said, well, they share common roots. The two founders were friends, and one focused more on the one side and the other focused more on the nature side, but they both share a common core. And I think that's what makes us witches, is that common core. We don't have to agree on everything.
We never will.
No, we won't. And if we did, we would, if we tried to force others, then there would be wars over this, which is what we don't want.
Right.
Yeah, but I do think that your books are a very good guide in a lot of ways for someone who is wanting to learn more about the path. And I think as you get more into it and you become more confident in your own spellcraft and you see the results, you know, I think one of the things that people get frustrated with is they take a spell like one of the ones that's in your book and they try to work it. It may not work for them the first time. And so you're going to have two people. You're going to either have one who gives up and says, this is BS, it doesn't work. And you're going to have the other person that goes, that didn't work. Why didn't that work? Mm-hmm. You know, and they start delving more into it. And those are the people that are going to become the modern day witches.
I'm very interested to see where all this will lead with all of the young people who are coming into it now.
I am curious as to where it's going to go. I think that my hopeful side says that as more people come to understand witchcraft and how to manifest your own power, that more people will take a hand in their own destiny. You know, think for more than 2,000 years, you've pretty much been told that your destiny is decided, you know, and there are, you know, the Church of Christ does not believe in predestination. In other words, some Protestant faiths believe that it's already determined who's going to go to heaven and who's not, which to me negates free will.
Right.
Then there are others that say, you know, no, you have to earn your way into it. And that's the Church of Christ that believes, you know, they're in that vein of theological thought processes that you should live the best life that you can to be deemed worthy to enter into the gates of heaven. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it is my hope that as more people understand that they can have a hand in their destiny, they can manifest abundance, they can manifest things that they want of their own power, because everything around us is energy and energy can be manipulated. If you don't think energy can be manipulated, then better turn off that light that you're utilizing.
People hopefully then use their energy and their intentions more wisely and
absolutely
with more overall awareness. So that, because what a lot of people don't understand is you're manifesting your life all the time anyway, whether you're doing
exactly
it and intentionally or whether you're just doing it randomly. And a lot of people who are doing what we might call black magic don't even know they're doing it. I mean,
if you've ever grumbled or slipped somebody the finger that cuts you off on the road, guess what you've just done?
If you curse somebody, then that's black magic. Now, you probably don't have a tremendous amount of power and focus when you're doing it, so you don't cause as much trouble as you could. But
yeah, I don't know about that, because I've seen some people use some pretty, you know, strong intentions with the FU.
But I think that once people understand also that, well, this is a Wiccan concept, it's not necessarily across the board for all witches, but that whatever you put out comes back to you. We're all connected. And so anything that you do to somebody else, and, you know, Jesus talked about this too. It's not only in.
Well, it's a rule of physics that every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah.
If you throw a rock and a stone a stone into a pond, that wave is going to go out and it eventually hits the shore and bounces back towards the source. So, you know, I'm not a, you know, how should I put this? I don't follow the rule of three specifically, but I do think that you need to be mindful of what you're putting out there, because some level of it will come back to you.
Right. It's more than three.
Exactly. Well, I had a very good friend named Fran Lawrence. I have a very good friend. I'm going to say had, like it's past tense. I have a very good friend named Fran. We aren't in as much touch as we used to be, but that's partially my fault. I just haven't reached out. But she explained it to me like this. Her opinion of it was the threefold isn't necessarily three times stronger. It affects the three aspects of your life, mental, physical, and emotional. And I thought, that's a very interesting thought.
Yeah.
That made more sense to me. right? Because if you look at the physics of it and throwing the rock in the pond, yes, it's true those waves come back, but they're usually not as strong as what went out, right? So I don't think it's going to come back to you three times as strong, but it can affect you in three different ways or right. three different manifestations of, you know. And so if you're going to do something, you need to, one, understand the consequences. And sometimes it's not possible to know the full consequences. There may be unexpected consequences that come out of that, and you need to be willing to accept responsibility for that and understand that that may happen. You know, there may be things that come out of that you didn't think about.
Yes, I agree with you.
And that, you know, what you do to one person, yes, that person might be your focus, but that person doesn't live in a vacuum. They have family, they have friends, they have coworkers, they have other people in their lives that will also be affected by what you do.
True. And I think that's what's important for us to understand, that there, as you were saying earlier, everything is energy. We're all energy. We're all connected. Everything is,
intertwined.
Everything, part of the whole, part of the source.
Right. We're all a part of that golden web of life and creation, and we create as we are created. So, you know, and that's not to say that there aren't bad people in the world, because we all know that there are just bad people. You know, usually end up being zero killers. Fortunately, I think there's fewer of them than there are of people who generally try to be good and kind and work towards harmony.
Right. I agree with you. I think most people are trying the best they can. They may be misguided, but they are doing.
And they may have undergone trauma that impacts their.
Haven't we all?
Behavior. And exactly. We all have. So it's for me, this is a healing path.
Yes.
Because to be able to heal others, you have to be able to heal yourself. And in order to heal others, you have to, and to heal yourself, you have to understand the trauma. So for me, it's a healing path by reconnecting the energy of the earth and the sky and air and fire and water. It's a path of bringing those things into yourself and understanding how to transmute those into something that will be abundant. You know, I personally, my personal opinion is, there is enough abundance within this planet for all of us to live an abundant life.
Of course. It's just that people need to be open to receiving that, first of all, and to believing that they deserve it.
And also, I think, willing to share aspects of it. Not saying you have to give away everything you earn or that you have to, you know, but giving back to the community, I think in some form is vital to your continued abundance. That's my personal opinion. I'm sure there are people who will disagree. But whether you're giving back as monetary, whether it's of your time, whether it's of your talent, whether it's of your ability to put out a good book that guides someone else on the healing path, if it's, you know, whatever.
Well, here's one of my weekly spiritual path rituals. I go to the supermarket and I look around and see if there's somebody that needs my help. For example, maybe there's an old person who can't stoop down to the bottom shelf to get something, or somebody that looks kind of sad and they're in the cat food aisle and I'll ask them about their pets. Or, you know, I always try to make this part of my regular practice, just to try to make somebody smile or help them in some way, in some ordinary fashion.
Exactly. Now, one thing that I did want to bring up that I just thought was so darn tootin' cute, because my friend Fran had suggested to me at some point that I write a book about Texas witchcraft in specific, okay. You know, how living in Texas impacts my craft. And I thought that's a great idea. So I'm working on it. I'm working on it. But in your book, I like highlighted darn near the entire section. You have one of my favorite things that I love to point out to people: Texas pentagram.
Texas can be what?
The pentagram. The
Texas pentagram. Everywhere.
If you travel to Texas, you'll spot pentagrams everywhere, won't you ever? Yeah, that five-pointed star's right on our flag, isn't it? So, you know, and people put them on their houses as decorations. And, you know, they're on our boots that we wear. And, you know, I think that it's so funny that people overlook those subtle little signs.
Well, there's one in the pavement, different paving stones in the center of our town, right in the middle of town square, a big one.
Love it. Been there, seen it. Yes, ma'am. Yes, yes. And it's one of those things that I just think is absolutely the funniest thing on the planet when you point out to people, well, that person's, look at that. They've got a pentacle right over here, right on their wall. Well, sure enough, it's a five-point star. Guess what the Texas Rangers wear? And I mean the law people. I mean the, it's not a police force, but I guess it's a state police force. But, you know, the Texas Rangers, not the baseball team. The actual people who go out and enforce the law and do special investigations in the state of Texas. An elite group of lawmen here. That's their sign. You know, they were the ones that were wearing the star. So
saved some lives too.
Yep. And you know, to me, that is a sign of their magic power right there. Right. So I just thought that was the cutest thing. And I was like, yep, let me highlight that whole section right here. Look at this. So, yeah, I thought that was very, very to the point. And it was kind of fun to chuckle over that because, yeah, I don't think many people think about that very much. But stars are, you know, we are the lone star state.
Right.
So it's, you know, hey, that might be a good title for the book, Lone Star Magic.
Could be. Sounds good to me.
Harnessing the power of state of Texas.
Well, I encourage you to do it.
I think I'm going to have to do that now. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, that was one of the things that she and I just kind of chit-chatted about is how does living in Texas impact your magic versus living? I've never really lived much of anywhere else. I was born in Colorado, but we moved to Texas during Christmas break of my first grade year. Mm-hmm. So I pretty much lived here my whole life at this point. And so I haven't had the opportunity to go out and really experience the magic of other places, but I can't imagine that it would be the same.
It is
similar.
I don't think it's the same. But one of the things that I noticed when I first moved here was the strong Native American, you know, mostly, I guess, around here, Comanche and
Creek, Cree.
Right. They're
in the Kickapoo. I think the Kickapoo lived in your area too.
Yeah, maybe. But the reverence for the land and the spirit, spirit guardians, the ancestors, I saw some of that blending in here with, some of the other types of witchcraft.
Yes. Because what a lot of people don't, I think a lot of people understand that Native Americans had medicine men and medicine women who were like the healers of their tribes, right? But they were so much more than that. They were counselors. They were the wisdom seekers, and they had the connection to the Great Spirit. And I think that that kind of energy is very much alive, especially in the Hill Country, not as much in the big city of Dallas, per se,
right?
But in the Hill Country, for sure, I think you get a lot of that sense.
And that was something that I noticed immediately when I came here that was different from being in Salem, Massachusetts, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I know that there's a number that you can text. Like if you send a text with your address or a zip code, it will tell you the indigenous populations who inhabited your land. When I first started my ovate work, that was something that I did because, like I said, I was trying to connect more with the land and somebody told me about that neat little number. And so I looked up who lived on this land before we did. And it was really cool. It was really neat to find that out and try to find the number, because I put it in the description, but I'm not finding it now. There's also an app, but I think they're still working on the app.
Well, when you find it, you can email it to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know I've texted it a few times, so I'll find it. It's around here. And I'll send it to you, but I'll also put it in the description for anybody else that's interested in knowing that. Because to me, that was step one for kind of getting to know. Oh, here it is. The number is 907-312-5085-5085.
Okay.
And all you do is just text your zip code or your city and state separated by a comma, and it will tell you what populations were there. Cool. So I find that a very helpful step for, you know, getting to know that. And that's very much true in the Hill Country and in East and West Texas too. Not so much up here unless you're out around the lakes and in the, you know, the city is just growing up so much around here. It's yikes. But so I know that we've been on for quite a while. I know I told you I would only take an hour of your time, but I do want to ask you about the feng shui, because I know that there's a lot of people that are there's a lot of debate within the community as to whether or not we should take on practices that are not of our specific cultural background. And so I think that keeps a lot of people from exploring some of the other pathways like hoodoo and mm-hmm. feng shui and things like that, that can be very useful. And for me, it's to me, if it's out there, then the wisdom is already there.
Exactly.
But I have to say, God wants us to separate ourselves.
Right. But the practice of feng shui in China, for example, is not quite, is different from what we mostly use here in this country. And part of that is because for us, feng shui is fairly new.
Right.
Where they've been using it for thousands of years there. So they could design their whole cities and their everything, their roadways around the feng shui concepts, whereas we have to adapt to what we've already got.
Right.
So that it is, there are lots of different types of feng shui. It's not all the same. And what I practice is not what would be practiced in China. The right. orientation would be different. But it's very, very useful. It's very effective. It's a form of magic also. I got into it because my first career was as an interior designer. And so I just naturally found that I was doing the stuff that I later learned was good feng shui just because it was good design.
Right. I think that the idea behind feng shui for people that are not super familiar with it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you are trying to increase and improve the flow of qi, which is life force energy, or exactly. vital force energy, as some of us call it, throughout exactly. your living space.
Right.
By eliminating dark areas within the home in which negative energy can manifest.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And when I walk into somebody's home, I can immediately see what's going on in that person's life, because it will show up in how he or she has arranged the furniture, or what kind of clutter they've got lying around, or where the, you know, lights are burned out, all that kind of stuff. It'll show you exactly what's going. Here's a funny story. A guy I dated who had real commitment issues was the most neat, orderly, immaculate person I've ever known, except in the part of his house that was what we call in feng shui, the relationship gua, the relationship section. That's where all the old junk went. That's where the recycling bins were. That's where the trash can was. All the junk that he never used was in that room.
That explains a lot. You must have picked up on that right away. Well, this guy's not funny. That's funny. You know, and here's the funny thing about that too, is that, you know, that to me indicates that feng shui is very personal on a lot of levels. So when you have two people living in one space, like myself and my husband, I think we're very opposite in our natures. My husband tends to be very negative oriented. He's the kind of person, and I don't want anybody to think badly about my husband, because if he was that horrible, obviously I wouldn't be here. But I mean, he can be very draining in some ways. I mean, everything that comes out of his mouth is negative. He's always got some nasty something to say about somebody on the TV or what's going on. And it's always, I hate this and I hate that. And I'm the person that's like, I love everybody. Animals are great. You know, and it's almost as if we're polar opposites. So when you, our design and our interests in design are often very different too. The way we would decorate.
Sure.
We can agree on some things, but there are other areas in which we just do not agree at all. So how would you work a feng shui? Like if somebody was asking you to come in and help them to feng shui their space, how mm-hmm. would you work that with two people that are so vastly different?
Well, the first thing that I always work on, and you were talking about, you know, the goal is to organize your home in such a way that the chi can flow smoothly through it. So the first thing I do is look to see where are there blockages. I mean, if you walk into a room, let's say, and the sofa's back is to you, you know right away you don't feel like you're welcome in that space. So I would reorganize the furniture, or as best I can, so that you have pathways that make it easy for people to walk through. And that's the same way that the chi will move. There are a lot of really easy things. I mean, the easiest of all feng shui cures is what we call them. You walk into a dark entryway of a house, for example, and you feel claustrophobic. You might feel a little anxious or nervous, like you might stub your toe on something. Flip a switch and all of a sudden you feel better. There's more positive energy in that space. That's a feng shui cure. And there are a lot of little things like that that you can do. I mean, ideally, if I were working with two people or more people that lived in a space together, I'd want to talk with all of them and converse with all of them. But usually it's so obvious that you just see things that can be rearranged a little bit one way or another. You don't necessarily have to redo everything in the house. You don't necessarily have to get rid of everything and start over again. Usually there are fairly simple things you can do, and there are many different ways to accomplish the same problem. So I have a book called 10 Minute Feng Shui, which has really easy cures that anybody can do. And most of them are not expensive. You don't have to do a whole lot. So, and the publisher just came out with a new version about 6 months ago, maybe, that's really beautifully illustrated in full color. And but lots of simple tips. And you're right, when you've got two people together who don't agree on stuff or don't have the same taste, it makes it more challenging, but you can still do it.
Well, that's very interesting, because when you said when you walk into a room and the back of the couch is to you, that's the way it is in our living room. But that's because our space is so weirdly laid out, because uh-huh. we have a fireplace. So there's only one way we can put our furniture with our entertainment center. So it's almost as if we're creating a walkway with the couches, if that makes sense. Because sure. one takes you down the hall to our bedroom and the other takes you, you know, into the living room, but you have to come around to sit on the couch. But that's because we can't move the entertainment center off the wall that it's on, because the other wall is the hallway to our bedroom. One, the other side is the fireplace, and then there's a bar. So mm-hmm. it's like we have to have it arranged that way. You know, and we've talked about not having like sofas, but having maybe just some chairs,
yep.
To make it seem a little more open and a little less closed. So that's interesting. That's very interesting. I might have to.
It does work. I've used it for many, many, many years. I couldn't even tell you how long I've used feng shui, but it really does work, and very quickly. So if I saw your house, I could probably you know, give you a better answer to what you've asked than I'm giving
you. Yeah, I'm just curious because I was like, man, because I've been trying to bring more light into the house. I thought maybe if there was more light in the house, it might help my husband's mood a little, you know. He has hyperosmia. He's highly sensitive to smells. So I try to keep things light. I don't burn a lot of incense in my home, which I love incense, but he's super sensitive to it. So I try to put only things that are going to be pleasant smelling.
Sure. Well, you can also, you know, use crystals to clear the air.
Yeah. Yeah. I do need to do that. I need to cleanse and place out crystals in the grid of my yard and around my home and within the house itself to try to clear some of that and kind of transmute his energy, because I think it doesn't serve him either. You know, I think part of him is so depressed that he's just locked. It's a pattern for him and he can't break out of it.
Yeah. Could be.
You know, that he's just been this way so long, it's habitual, and he doesn't even realize the toxicity that he's putting out. Mm-hmm. Or he's gotten to a point where he doesn't care, which is even worse. So, interesting. But, well, I definitely think that we ought to check that out. So where can the listeners find your books?
Well, they're all on Amazon. They're on Barnes & Noble and other online sites. You can always go to a bookstore and ask your bookseller to order them, which is nice. Most people, are more impulse buyers now, but there's stores here in my little town even that carry my books. They're pretty widely distributed because I am with big publishers. So for the most part, they're pretty accessible.
Very good. All right. So everybody knows where to find you. I just want to tell you that I appreciate having you on.
Well, thank you so much.
It's been fun just to talk. And I'm going to have to get down that area. If you're ever up in the Dallas area, holler at me. There's lots of metaphysical shops up here we can go scope out. In fact, they opened a new one in Denton just this year that I haven't had a chance to go and check out yet. So,
well, I'm really thrilled we got to talk and to meet you this way. And maybe we'll get to meet in person sometime.
I certainly hope so. Well, thank you so very much.
To your show now. I've been to your, you know, your blog, and do you post it at a particular time? And I'm just thinking,